dedicated to each and every one of you who appreciate a great glass of wine. You know what I mean?
Sunday, let's raise a glass to the beginning of another week. It's time to unscrew, uncork, or saber a bottle, and let's begin exploring the wine glass. Please take a moment to scroll down or swipe to subscribe, rate, and review Exploring the Wine Glass. That 1 minute it will take you is so valuable to helping other wine lovers find me on podcast channels. Today, I am socially distancing in a unique tasting room in Paso Robles. I am sharing a glass with Todd Roth, owner of Hayseed in Houston. His winery is a true Garagiste. In fact, his tasting room is in a renovated garage. In addition to making small lot, high quality wine, Hayseed in Houston is equally committed to giving back to the local community. So sit back and enjoy the conversation, and then head to hayseedinhouston.com to check out their amazing wines. Sláinte! Hey everybody, I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program, sommelier service, and WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all of the socials, as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now's the perfect time to swipe, subscribe, rate, and review. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Allure of the Pour, sponsored by Dracena Wines. Today I have a special treat for you. I am sitting down with Ted Roth of Hayseed, and we are in the tasting garage here in Paso Robles. So I am excited. The reason why I found Ted, thank goodness for social media, was because of his unique situation where he gives back so much to his to Paso Robles. So welcome, Ted, and
nice to meet you, Lori. Thank you very much for having me on.
Absolutely. So the first thing I always do, my very first question is always the origin story, right? That's the most interesting thing to me, is how does somebody get into the wine industry? Because as us in the wine industry know, it's not all glamour and fame and get rich fast. So how did you get into the wine industry?
Well, I mean, an interesting story, I guess. I mean, my joke, upon moving to Paso, we had really no interest in being in the business necessarily, other than as consumers of wine. That's why we moved here. We love Paso wines and what the community is all about. But what we found out upon moving here is that it's really hard not to get kind of pulled into the industry. Pretty much everybody we met is either in the wine industry or sleeping with somebody that's in the wine industry. So anyway, but how I got involved specifically was I was introduced to a gentleman named Enrique Torres and his wife Nora, and they were just about to launch a brand called Diablo Paso, which now they have a tasting room in downtown Paso on Park Street. But it was before they started selling their wines, which they started making back in 2012. I think that was their first vintage. And they were ready to start selling their wines and pop-up events and things like that. But they didn't really have much of a marketing plan, didn't have a website yet, things like that. And so my background is digital marketing. It's what I spent most of my career doing. My career was long enough so that there was no such thing as digital when I started. But anyway, I ended my career at least in digital marketing. So I offered to put together a plan for them and then execute on that plan to help them get their brand out there and, you know, to create some awareness for what they were all about, and ultimately built their website and handled their email outreach. Worked in their tasting room for about 2.5 years, just all for fun. So no money was ever exchanged. It was just me kind of helping out a young couple. Enrique is an awesome winemaker at another brand, and his wife Nora worked at the Housing Authority and still does, actually. So, and they've got young kids. And so it was just something I wanted to do to kind of help them, and that is really what got me introduced to the industry, is anything beyond just being a consumer of wine. And in 2016, Enrique asked me if I wanted to make wine with him. And that was after helping them for about 3 years with their brand. And I'm like, sure, why not? Well, what are we going to do with it?
Who's going to say no?
Yeah. What are we going to do with it? And he said, well, someday you'll sell it. And that's really what Hayseed in Houston is about. It's the wines that he and I started making together back in 2016. It's my business. They're my wines. I'm learning to make wine through Enrique and through another great winemaker named Steve Anglum. So I'm through my fifth harvest now, so I still call myself kind of a beginner, and I'm still mentoring under a couple of really talented winemakers. But anyway, that's kind of the story in a nutshell.
That's impressive, you know, and
I think that's how so many of us came into the wine world is, you know, you have a little bit of interest in it some way or another, and then it, you know, it draws you in. For us, we did a make wine with us type mm-hmm. thing, and everybody kept saying, oh, yours is really good. You should mm-hmm. do that. You should do that. And, you know, the little, the one side of the shoulder is saying, are you insane?
Right.
And the other one's like, yeah, we can do this. We can do this.
Yeah. And that angel devil thing is still there probably. It never goes away.
No, right? No.
So every... always a limited amount of doubt, but, you know, right. But whatever.
Right. So how did you find Paso? Were you just visiting it as a wine lover and said, yeah, I want to make this my home?
Pretty much. Interestingly, I grew up only about 2 hours east of here, hence the name Hayseed, which is another nice way of saying country bumpkin or
pick. Okay.
So I grew up about 2 hours east of here, so I had some familiarity with Paso Robles growing up, you know, kind of as a place to stop and get a big gulp on your way to Pismo Beach or something. So I didn't really recognize what was developing and what was happening in Paso Robles in the last, say, 15 to 20 years insofar as wine is concerned. But always enjoyed wine and spent most of my adult life in Southern California where I raised my family. My fiance and I started coming up here, progressing our way up the California coast and going to different appellations, you know, Los Olivos and Santa Barbara, Fox and Trail and so on. And then eventually got to Paso Robles and really fell in love with what we saw in the community. Visually, you know, the quotient of really good restaurants. We have what we call the MFQ, which stands for MF quotient. So Paso had a fairly high MFQ. We started thinking about maybe someday retiring here and thought one way to try to accelerate that a little bit or commit to that was to buy a home that we would rent to somebody. So just to invest in a rental property in Paso. And when coming up here to kind of work on the rental property and get it ready to rent, we changed our minds and decided instead to keep it as a weekend home. And then as soon as we could, which was about 2 years later, we moved here full time. And that was about 9 years ago. So, and we've just been in love with Paso ever since.
And I think that that's the thing. That's how we found Paso because I wanted Southern California to retire to. My husband wanted Northern California. And we legit were like, hey, here's this middle place. Well, you know, let's try it. And at that point, this was like 15, 20 years ago. There wasn't a lot of wine here, right? So it wasn't like, ooh, Paso, you know. Mm-hmm. So we came in here and we're like, oh my gosh, there's wine here. And then that was it. We were hook, line, and sinker stuff. And I think the thing that really makes Paso special are the people and the relationships that are formed. And as you were saying, how you have these mentors, and they're more than happy to just to share with you their knowledge and their experience. And that's what makes, I think, Paso, Paso.
Absolutely. It's the most collaborative community I've ever lived in. And I've bounced around and lived quite a few places in my life, both as a young person and as an adult. And it's an extraordinarily collaborative industry. I mean, one person cannot make wine. I mean, it takes a set of hands, a few sets of hands, actually. And in my case, it takes somebody with a little bit more acumen around the winemaking process. Still, it'll be another 5-6 years before I can make wine without phoning a friend or getting some help. So, yeah, it's a very collaborative community and industry. And it's just a really fun place to live. It's a fun place to work. And in my case, it's one of the real reasons why I've decided to commit 50% of my profits to supporting the community through the sponsorship of different nonprofits that I kind of work with. So,
and like I said at the beginning, that is how I found you. Was I was scrolling through Instagram and your feed popped up and you had the Wines for Paws, and that is really, I mean, that's obviously heart and soul to us, the animals. But you have on your wall here, you have four different associations that you deal with. How did you choose them? Why did you choose them?
Yeah, well, and as I've augmented my inventory somewhat with wines I've been making the past couple of years, I have now about 7 different nonprofit partners that I support altogether. And I'm looking for an 8th because I have a new Albarino that I'm going to bottle sometime in the spring. And we'll want to commit the profits from that Albarino to a new nonprofit. So I should be up to about 8 before it's all said and done. But so each organization looks after a segment of the community that I care about. So it's folks in abusive relationships that need some help. you know, in times of crisis, so whether it's counseling or shelter or what have you. And for that reason, I support RISE, which, you know, is here in town. It's a great organization that looks after folks that are, you know, experiencing intimate partner abuse, sexual assault, that sort of thing. My Rosé raises money for Paso Cares, and they look after our homeless community. They have a meal program that runs 365 days a year, which is fantastic. So if you're homeless and hungry, there's a place that you can go every single day at 5 o'clock and get a nice nourishing meal from Paso Cares. My Grenache raises money for CASA. So of the different nonprofit organizations I support, CASA is really the only one that is not founded and focused entirely on either Paso or San Luis County 805 area code, which is where we live. CASA is a national organization, but of course we have a chapter here. And CASA stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocates. So advocates that volunteer on behalf of the courts to look after kids in the foster care system, which is obviously a much needed service. My niece kind of turned me on to CASA because she's a CASA advocate. I'm also pouring today La Macha, which is a blend of three different Spanish varietals. And it's my most recently released wine. So it's my newest nonprofit partner. That partner is 805 on DocuFund. And a tremendous organization started by kids literally in their 20s, maybe early 30s. They're all dreamers that when they got out of school wanted to get back to their community here in the 805 area code. So the geographic scope is from Paso down to about Oxnard and Ventura area. And they started 805 DocuFund, which is a 501c3 nonprofit. And their mission is to give financial assistance to working families that don't have always access to government funds because of their immigration status. Last year, these young kids gave about $3 million in financial assistance to families in the 805 area code. So they're making a huge impact in the communities that they're from and are a part of. You know, and it's obviously something that's much, much needed in our community because we rely on people to a huge extent that are here doing a lot of the heavy lifting in the vineyard and in the wineries and so on that are here not necessarily with papers. So great organization. I also support through a blend that I'm currently sold out of called Warrior. I support an organization called Operation Surf. Operation Surf was founded by a professional surfer named Van Carraza and his wife Amanda, who's their executive director. They're based in Avila Beach, so it's one of our closer surfing beaches. And their mission is to take veterans who've come back from areas of conflict, Iraq and Afghanistan specifically, out surfing as a form of therapy. So those that have, you know, come back from those areas with PTSD or other injuries, you know, they take out for what they call ocean therapy. So tremendous organization. They've got a kind of a legion of volunteers up and down the California coast that help them put on either weekend events or courses that could take as long as 6 months to complete. For somebody that has a military background that has, again, been in conflict, who perhaps lost an arm or a leg or both in combat, they have a whole curriculum around getting that person back out in the water and comfortable in a safe environment and to experience that ocean therapy. So
that's incredible.
Yeah.
That's so unique, so Central Coast. So that's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I was supporting Wellness Kitchen, which is based in Templeton, through the sale of Mike Cabernet, which I called West of Eden. And Wellness Kitchen is a tremendous organization. It was here about 12 years, providing nourishing meals to people in critical care and some sort of health crisis. They didn't have the financial means to get good quality nutrition. So, you know, non-GMO, organically grown produce, bone broth, things of that nature. And, you know, tremendous organization. Again, 12 years of service to the community. But unfortunately, they were a victim, if you will, of COVID. So they operated as a commercial kitchen, and the money that they made selling packaged meals to people, they reinvested in providing those meals to people in critical care for free. And because of the shutdown of the restaurants and things of that nature, they were just not able to hold it together. And so it looks like they permanently closed, and just means that, you know, there are a lot of people here that are thankful for the service that they got from Wellness Kitchen for many, many years. Themselves or a loved one who was, again, experiencing some sort of health crisis. And Nancy Walker, who is the founder of Wellness Kitchen, and I are working together to find an alternative, somebody to replace Wellness Kitchen as a recipient of the money that I raised selling my Cabernet.
That's incredible. So you actually answered my question. Like, so how are you doing the give back? But each varietal or each bottle you have has a representative charity.
Yeah, it's a 50-50 split. So I give 50% to worthy organizations, and I keep half for myself. But I like to say I'm a bit of a greedy person, so because I keep half.
That's not greedy at all. That's so much more than what many others are willing to give. I think you're extremely generous. I think that's fantastic. So let's talk about, first of all, you said your first vintage was 2016?
Yeah, 2016, Enrique and I started making wines together then. I knew virtually nothing about the winemaking process. I think I helped him two previous vintages sort fruit, but mostly what that meant was I was smoking a cigar and having a glass of wine while he worked. So in 2016, he challenged me to actually help him and gave me the opportunity to buy some fruit with him. And so we did that. And again, with the goal of it, these wines someday becoming mine and something that I would sell, which I now am. So we started by making Cabernet and Petit Sirah separately, not co-fermented. Okay. And then ultimately I blended those. And that was my first vintage of Warrior. So when I opened a year ago, August, when that 2016 Warrior blend was ready, that it was one of the four first wines that I started to offer. And that's the one that raised money for Operation Surf. Hence the name Warrior.
Warrior.
Yeah.
I get it all. The whole big picture. See, you have, there's that marketing, right? The digital, you know, that whole thing. All right. So this bottle that you have here is La Macha. Okay. And your label is hay.
Yeah. It's like
hay.
Hay seed.
Right. So everybody who can find you on Instagram, I see lots of your photos with the hay seeds in front of the thing, so completing the digital. On the back label we have...
Yeah, each of the back labels, the front labels are fairly consistent with the hay pattern, and of course the brand name hay seed, and then the name of the wine, if it has a name, or the varietal. The back labels are unique to the varietal, and are meant to relate to the different nonprofit organization, either their mission or the segment of our community that they look after. So in the case of La Macha, I have an image of a person who's a field worker, a Latina. The name La Macha basically means, you know, it's the feminine version of El Macho. People mostly understand what macho means, kind of tough guy or what have you. So they use La Macha too from time to time to refer to somebody who, equal to her male counterparts, is out doing a lot of hard work and heavy lifting, and in this case, it's an image of a lady that you know, works in a vineyard somewhere. So,
and your blend this year is Graciano, very nice, Mataro, and Garnacha. So, is it always those three in different percentages, or does it vary depending on vintage to vintage?
It'll vary to some extent. So, La Macha is a collaboration between Enrique and I. So, while I've kind of spun off now and I've got my own brand and kind of my own program and so on, and while we're not financially linked, we're still very good friends, and he's still assisting me in my learning in winemaking. And so, in 2018, we collaborated on La Macha, and it is a blend of those three varietals that you mentioned. It's about 56% Graciano, so its primary blend component is Graciano, and about an even split on the Garnacha and Mataro. But we also did this wine in 2019. In 2019, it's got a little less Graciano, and we've added some Tempranillo. And then similar in 2020. Difference in 2018 versus 2019 and 2020 is in 2018 we blended. 2019 and 2020, we co-fermented these fruits. So, you know, so there'll be some changes to La Macha as the program matures. Although I'm still excited about doing verticals and things of that nature, so people can taste the difference. But the blend components will vary from time to time, and it has a lot to do with our ability to get good quality fruit in order to co-ferment at literally on the same day from the vineyards that we source from. And one of my goals is to always source fruit from sustainably farmed vineyards, which I do. Three of the four that I get fruit from year after year are SIP certified, so sustainability in practice. So it's important to me that we do right by the land. And so sometimes that dictates, you know, small changes in the components of a blend or the percentages of what I'm able to do just because of the availability of select fruit, premium grade fruit from those vineyards. So it's the hardest challenge for me as a small winemaker and someone with only roughly 5 years of experience in Paso is access to really good quality fruit. I don't want to cut corners. Another thing that's kind of a hallmark of hayseed is that we don't do any sort of chemical intervention We don't do any additives, refining agents, proteins, whether animal or plant-based. It's basically, you know, a little bit of sulfite, less than 20 parts per million, and we inoculate with quality yeast and then let the wine do its thing. So there's really nothing in the wines, very clean wines. You know, so for me, it's, you know, it's going to be interesting every year to see what I get. And it's not a goal to strive for, you know, perfect consistency from vintage to vintage in terms of flavor or texture or what have you. There are going to be some variances because of climate and other things, and I kind of welcome that. So to me, that's what makes winemaking fun.
Absolutely. You know, there are some major wine labels out there that haul in a lot of dollars per bottle just because they have a specific name. And it's their goal is literally to make the same wine vintage after vintage because people say, oh, I know that label.
Correct.
And they expect the same thing over and over. And, you know, we need to, like, you know, we know how they make
the same. Yeah. Lots of tricks and tools.
Yes. Yeah. It's a little difficult to have the same wine year in, year out if you're allowing the fruit and the soil and the climate to speak.
Absolutely.
You know?
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Right, like said, it gonna set my soul, gonna set my soul.
Did you know that Dracena Wines has a wine club? We named it the Chalk Club. Draco is on our label, but Vegas was getting a bit jealous, so we decided he deserved to be our wine club spokesdog. In Las Vegas, betting chalk means that you are betting on all of the favorites, and we're gambling that once you taste our wines, we will become one of your favorite wineries. The club is simple, yet a bit different than most. We don't ask for a lot of commitment like others do. Choose between three tiers. The Sweet 16, where you'll receive three bottles twice a year and get 25% off all orders. Sign up for the Elite 8 and get 30% off all orders and receive four bottles twice a year. Or make it to the Final Four and receive six bottles twice a year, as well as receiving 35% off all purchases. All tiers receive discounted shipping, are customizable, and are eligible for unlimited referral bonuses. Add $15 to your bank for each person you refer. Head to www.dracenawines.com or the link in the show notes to find out all the Chalk Club has to offer and to sign up. We've stocked the odds so that you can get our award-winning wines without breaking the bank.
So this... When with the La Mancha, do you have a profile like in your head that you would like to see it be it? Granted, it's going to change from vintage to vintage, but is there, you know, are you looking, you've got a female on the back, it's a female term, are you looking for it to be a more feminine wine?
It's a little bit of both, not so feminine actually. La Mancha is, it has lots of different meanings, and I by no means pretend to be an expert at the Spanish language. I know a few words and phrases and had some time working in Mexico in my career, so I have a little bit of familiarity, but I don't want to, yeah, but there's also some variance from one Latin American country, Spanish speaking country to the next. But the connotation of La Mancha is really somebody that's kind of tough.
Oh, okay.
So not necessarily feminine, but it is a medium-bodied wine, and there is some delicacy to it. The Graciano has got a lot of spice and personality. It's a very complex varietal into itself. It's becoming a little more popular in the Paso area for some very interesting reasons, but it tolerates the heat here very well. It grows well and produces beautiful wine. But it does have a level of spice that makes it kind of interesting. The Mataro, which is basically a Spanish clone of Mouvedra, has some earthiness to it. And so those two varietals alone are relatively powerful and are going to read as such in the glass. But that's why then I add the Garnacha, because the Garnacha's got this kind of balance and a nice sweetness.
Sweet. I was going to say, it's got a sweetness. It's got a little hint of floral, which is playing very nicely with the spice.
Right. So it shows that there is a feminine side.
It's like sugar and spice,
exactly.
But not that being sweet.
So there is a feminine side to La Mancha. So while it's tough and powerful, it can be soft and you know, kind of sweet as well. So that's, you know, I like to say that the Garnacha is there to keep the other two from fighting with one another.
There you go. Right? And you can't always judge a book by its cover,
sure.
Right? It's beautiful. The... the aroma, first of all, the color is beautiful. It's I would say medium minus ruby with nice little translucent on this on the edges. And it the aromas are just there's spice, a little hint of maybe coffee bean. Mm-hmm. But what really gets me is that little white flower mm-hmm. that's on the end that peeks through. Like on your first sniff, it's not there. And then you're like, oh, this is good. Let me bring it back to my nose. And then there's this nice little hint. And I like what you're saying. It keeps the other two from, you know, it's like what is the middle sibling, right?
Exactly.
It keeps the
Marsha, Marsha, Marsha.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. That's beautiful. So how many cases did you have in 2016?
Of
your total production?
Oh, very, very small. We had 3 barrels of 2016 wine. So when I opened a year ago, August, I had a 2016 Warrior, which was those 3 barrels, roughly 80 cases of Warrior. I made Pinot Noir with Henrique in 2017. So that wine was ready to release last August, August 9th, 2019. And I had roughly 80 cases of the Pinot Noir as well. I had maybe 50 cases of Grenache Rosé, oh. And then also a Chardonnay from Edna Valley, which is Jesperson Vineyard, which is still the Chardonnay. I'm in my 2019 vintage now, that same Chardonnay. But I had that when I launched. So I started with roughly 450 cases.
Okay.
And that was my first release of wines. Was virtually sold out of all of those wines by February. Was bottling again mid-March. Because of COVID, we were really requested to stop pouring wines in the tasting room in March and April, as you know, and into mid to late May, which was honestly not a problem for me because I was out of my wines anyway. And those that I bottled in March really needed some bottle time before they were ready for release. And just around the time I was ready to start releasing my second release of wines, those wines I bottled in March, we were given the okay to start pouring again in the tasting room. So timing-wise, things were pretty good. My second release of wines, roughly 600 cases.
Okay.
But my annual production now, based on what I've been buying in 2019 and now 2020 harvest, is around 800 cases.
Okay. And is that where you would like to stay? I think every winemaker, you know, artisanal winemaker, boutique wine, has a number in their head that they don't really want to go over or they don't want to, you know, they want to get to. Do you have a number in your head that you would like to get to or stay at?
Yeah, I think about 1,000 cases a year is something I can do pretty comfortably. I mean, this is something of an encore career for me. I retired from my career in marketing services the day before I opened here a year ago August.
So nice retirement.
Yeah.
12 hours.
Yeah, I know. I call it pre-retirement because I'm pretending to be retired. I mean, I'm here more hours than I ever worked in my career probably each week. But so to get too big and to take on the burden and, you know, to commit the financial wherewithal to growing a brand that ultimately is going to find its way on supermarket shelves and things of that nature is not really what I'm looking to do in life. I mean, my primary goal is, A, to have a little fun and be part of the community, but more importantly, B, raise money for and awareness for a lot of local nonprofits. So growing my brand and increasing my case production does give me the opportunity to generate a little bit more revenue for my nonprofit partners. So to that extent, I welcome growth. But insofar as it being, how I spend my time just personally, I don't want it to get to a point where it's a job. You know, I really want to continue to do this and keep it fun, which it's been. And I think I'd be very comfortable if I just kind of got to 1,000 cases a year, 1,200 maybe tops. I can probably do that through my small space here, the tasting garage in Paso Robles. Anything larger than that, I don't know that this location would sustain the throughput I would need to be able to sell more cases than that, but possibly. So yeah, after all the effort I put into this, the idea of moving sometimes just because I'm growing as a brand isn't very appealing. I think I would just like to enjoy this space for a few years, and I think I can do that with about 1,000, maybe 1,200 cases a year. So.
And with that being said, so we are tasting in a garage,
yes.
Which is beautiful, by the way. But I love the doors. I love everything about it. So tell me about the garage. Like, how did you, like, oh, this garage is, used for something else, and now I can turn it into a tasting room. How did you come about to tasting here, which is on Railroad? What's the address actually?
1122 Railroad Street. Okay. Yeah, so I'm one block off of the main square, the City Park, Downtown Park in Paso Robles. So really, proximity-wise, it's a good location, although Railroad Street itself is not a street known for having a lot of tasting rooms. There is a setup across the street, which is called Paso Underground, where there are four or five different small wineries, which is really only open on weekends. But there's also a big plan that the city of Paso Robles has to develop Railroad Street, and that all of these commercial buildings become ultimately either tasting rooms or brew pubs, things of that nature. So the city was very easy to work with insofar as me getting a business permit here and making sure that the garage, former garage, is adequate as a retail space with important things to satisfy ADA and make it easier for people with disabilities to be able to come here and enjoy my wines as well. So, but I just happened to be driving by and I saw a four-lease sign on a very unattractive garage with a chain-link fence that was falling down in the front and an old, all in 1985 when the building was built, garage door, plywood garage door that was very unattractive. So I've certainly, made some effort to dress the place up a bit and make it more comfortable for folks and make it a little more attractive. I owe a debt of gratitude to my friend Mark, whose picture is here on the wall.
Okay.
He and I grew up together. He is absolutely a hayseed, as I am. So he grew up in the country about 2 hours east of here, and he still lives in that vicinity now. So last summer when I was building this space out, he came to Paso Robles maybe 5 or 6 times. He's a carpenter, so he's got tremendous skills and tools that I'll never have. And so really, he deserves credit for kind of pulling all this all together, and I would kind of hand him stuff, like tools, and go grab him lunch when he got hungry and that sort of thing. But, thanks to my friend Mark Sims, I was able to get this thing put together pretty quickly and open by August 1st, which was the goal. So
you have 3 other photos. What are the other?
Yeah, I like to say those are my hayseed heroes. So they're ordinary people that did extraordinary things with their lives, but generally people that most people have not heard of. Well, I guess there's an exception to that. I just told you about my friend Mark.
Right.
But I like to say they're my hayseed heroes because they generally from the Southwest, small communities where they were raised. So the gentleman in the upper left, his name was Doris Miller. And, he was a true hero. So he was a 7th grade dropout, joined the U.S. Navy shortly before Pearl Harbor or World War II, and was on a boat in Pearl Harbor that got torpedoed. And he was messman 3rd class. His job was to peel potatoes in the kitchen, as African Americans at that point in the U.S. Navy were sometimes kind of relegated to. And he, when the boat got torpedoed that he was on, he ran up to the upper deck and saw dead and dying sailors all around, saw that there was an unmanned 50 caliber machine gun, so he jumped on it, taught himself how to shoot it, because they never trained him on how to shoot anything.
Wow.
Other than a potato, and shot down 2 Japanese arrows, and for that he was awarded the Naval Cross. So he was the first African-American to ever receive the Naval Cross. Interesting story, they brought him back and put him on a bit of a road show to raise money through bond sales, largely in the African-American community at that time. And after a couple of months of that, they put him back on a boat in the South Pacific. It was sunk and he was killed.
Oh.
So I put that photo up a year ago, August, when I opened. I just thought it was a tremendous story of, again, somebody that was an ordinary life but did something extraordinary. In his case, a demonstration of true heroism. And so I put that picture up in August. And then in November, the U.S. Navy decided to name a carrier after Doris Miller. So it's the first time the U.S. Navy has ever named a boat after an enlisted man. So, interesting story.
Kudos.
So now some people will walk in and recognize who he is and his story. To his right is a lady named Maria Moreno, and she was part of that big diaspora of people that came to California during the 30s, during the Dust Bowl, but a part of that community that most of us don't talk about. She was a farm worker, so she was of Mexican descent, and a lot of people that settled here at that time were not just the farmers who lost their farms, but the workers that were unemployed and lost their jobs because of the Dust Bowl and came here to seek a better life. So she did that in the 30s. She was married at 15, had 12 children when she moved to California. But ultimately, she was identified by the AFL-CIO as somebody that had a lot of passion and spoke well for her people in negotiating better living conditions with some of the farming concerns that were supporting the community up in the Sacramento area where she lived. And so was identified by the AFL-CIO as and named as her first ever farm labor union organizer when the AFL-CIO was interested in breaking into farm labor. And that was, again, back in the mid-40s. And so she attended their national convention as a delegate for farm labor and worked with the AFL-CIO for a few years. But realistically, after 6 or 7 years with the AFL-CIO, kind of realized they were not doing a whole heck of a lot to help her people. So she was very outspoken, and she called them on it, and they fired her. And consequently, they failed in their attempt to organize farm labor. So it took another 20 years for Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta to come through and form the UFW and actually, you know, organize farm labor as we know it to be today, you know, simply because of the history at the time. But she was the least likely person for that job. She was Latina. She was a she. And so, you know, in the case of at least these two images, Doris Miller represents a warrior, so kind of in line with my warrior blend, you know, honoring military people that have committed, you know, their lives or, you know, a lot more to military service. And in the case of Maria Moreno, a strong survivor. So she is both a Latina and a La Macha, if you will, and somebody that perhaps maybe in her life could have benefited from some of the services that RISE provides to the community. So just little connections there. John Steinbeck is in the lower left, and so he's a bit of a ringer. Everybody knows John Steinbeck. But he's roughly, largely, I mean, from this area, really more Monterey County, Salinas, and so on, but absolutely a hayseed, small town boy makes good.
Definitely.
America's, you know, probably best known author next to Ernest Hemingway. But my favorite author, John Steinbeck, and he wrote a lot about this part of California, this part of the United States, and in most of his books that take place in Western United States, he mentions Paso Robles. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of fun when I read through things like East of Eden, I'll see, you know, quite a few references actually to Paso Robles as a place that he spent some time and he included in his novels. So, and then again, my friend Mark to the right. So I hate seed heroes.
That's beautiful. I love it. I absolutely love it. So tell me, we know it's Hayseed.
Hayseed in Houston.
On Instagram?
Yeah, it's at Hayseed Wine.
Okay.
So H-A-Y-S-E-E-D Wine. So at Hayseed Wine is my Instagram. The website is, you know, www.hayseedanhouston, H-O-U-S-D-O-N. And that was my grandmother's last name.
Okay.
So just a little, you know, alliteration, H-N-H, Hayseed in Houston.
Okay. And are you also on Twitter?
I'm not on Twitter.
Not on Twitter.
Instagram, Facebook. Well, you know, I am definitely bootstrapping and doing a lot of the marketing myself. It probably shows in my executions, but I'm kind of keeping it focused a little bit. I mean, I'll never stop evaluating different channels. And, you know, when I feel like I've got critical mass and have, you know, enough people following me or liking me or what have you in one social media network I may then consider another, but for the time being, it's really just Facebook and Instagram, my website. And
so no TikTok yet?
No TikTok.
We're not going to see you dancing anytime soon?
No. Maybe when I get if I get a winery dog.
Okay.
Or a winery cat. I haven't decided yet.
All right. Well, I will say, when he's on, there's more likes and comments than anything else. When Vegas is on the picture,
it
you know, the dog lovers out there, the cat lover, and you know, you could do that whole Catterday, you know, Saturday thing, whatever.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Ted. This has been incredible. I'm so happy I found you on Instagram. So see, marketing does work on Instagram.
Thank you.
And I hope that everybody can stop by in Paso, take a little bit further, what is this, south? Of downtown?
Yeah, a little bit east and south, sure.
East and south of downtown. Take a little walk down railroad and come here because the garage is amazing. I absolutely love it. And is this also your case storage? Do you have case storage back here?
No, I use a offsite warehouse.
Offsite warehouse.
Yeah, I have my barrels at Anglin Wines, which is where I have my AP. So I process my fruit at Anglin Wines and Custom Crush down in Tin City, and then my case goods are elsewhere. So.
Okay, awesome. But this is incredible. And pre-COVID and hopefully soon post-COVID, how can they schedule? Is it schedule appointment? Is that how you see yourself in the future?
Yeah, mostly it's a small space. I can hold about 20 people comfortably. Weekends get very busy, as you can imagine. So I absolutely enjoy it when people make reservations and are assured of a table and a seat. So yeah, and they can call me, or my phone number is available on my Instagram as well as on my website. Or of course send me an email or a message, private message through Instagram or Facebook. So all of the above.
All of the above. Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for sharing your story. And I personally thank you for giving back to so many of the Paso organizations, because as I said at the beginning, I think that's, I mean, Paso has incredible wine, but it's really the people here in Paso that make Paso Paso, in
Absolutely.
My opinion. And you are incredible to be so generous in giving back to so many. But I do want to go back to one last question. The Albarino, you are looking for a charity to...
I have a couple of candidates.
Candidates, so okay.
I'm approached often because, of course, there's a great need among nonprofits to, you know, to be able to find funds where they can. And so I have a couple of candidates.
Okay. I was gonna ask you, how can a charity, do they reach out to you and...
Yeah, I
just
mean, I'll certainly talk to anybody in my programs. It's going to evolve over time for sure. I've already seen some attrition in losing one of my nonprofit partners as a consequence of COVID. So, but I do want to stay somewhat focused on the relationships I have and make sure those are relationships I keep for a long time to come. But yeah, there's, I want to cover a lot of bases. So I've got veterans and homeless people and animals and, you know, people in abusive relationships and so on. So I want to make sure that the nonprofit for the Albarino is fits in nicely with serves a segment of the community maybe that is a little bit underserved.
Okay, awesome. Well, thank you very much for, first of all, talking
you.
To me, sharing this La Mancha, which is incredible. So
thank you.
Raise a glass. Slancha.
Slancha.
Thank you.
Every time.
This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I am also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoytbud. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed what you heard, please rate, review, and subscribe to help others find me more easily. And most importantly, tell your wine-loving friends, because if you like the podcast, they will too. Music is Wine by Kevens. Until next week, slancha.
Give me the red, red wine. Give me the blush, blush wine. Give me the white, white wine. Oh yeah.